Hello, welcome or welcome back to the Just Eat Normally podcast for eating disorder recovery with me, Dr. Rachel Evans. I am a psychologist, hypnotherapist with a PhD in the psychology of eating and specialist training in eating disorder recovery, as well as personal experience of going through an eating disorder and coming out the other side, which makes me super passionate about what I do. And in every episode, as with my one-to-one clients, I'm bringing you academic knowledge, information and theories, as well as therapeutic skills and personal experiences, be that mine or experiences of my guests, for a unique perspective on eating disorder recovery. So join me on this podcast as I speak to fellow experts in eating disorder recovery, eating disorder survivors with inspiring stories, and also throw in some bite-sized solo episodes with recovery tips or new ways for you to think about things. The goal of this podcast is to give you food for thought, to shift your mindset, to boost your motivation, and to help you find your own version of normal eating, which will allow you to live a truly nourished life. Hey everyone, welcome back to Just Eat Normally podcast. And today I'm here with Caroline Drummond-Smith, and she is a mother of three. She lives in Froome. Whereabouts is Froome?
Froome is about 20 minutes from Bath.
Okay, yeah, I was thinking like Devon, so I suppose it's sort of that area.
To Somerset border, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, lovely. So you live with your husband of 31 years. So now she is a certified health coach and the owner of Zest Health Coaching, specializing in eating disorders and obesity. And she helps people to have a healthy relationship with food and their body and be the best, happiest versions of themselves. So it took her many years of working through her own issues before she came to a place of true happiness and self-acceptance. She suffered from anorexia for 30 years, but through a full recovery has learned what it really means to accept herself, flaws and all. And she was terrified of who she would be without the eating disorder, but now is living a life that she never dreamed would be possible. After years of abusing her body, she now treats it with the love and respect it deserves. And I did ask Caroline to send me a bio before, but I just love that because I think it encapsulates so many things that people thinking about dipping their toe into recovery are going to be feeling like, is that even possible for me? So I'm super excited to talk to you. You are the inspiration that this is totally possible. Before we start, is there anything else you'd like to say to introduce yourself?
I don't think so. No, that was pretty complete. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I'm just here to really give hope to people that, you know, after 30 years and, you know, in the thick of it, I thought, well, this is just it. This is my life. But yeah, it is possible and it's never too late.
Yeah. Oh, I've already got goosebumps when you're saying this, because I do get so many messages from people saying, this is my age. So maybe in their 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s, I think I've even had someone who was 70 saying like, is this too late? My answer is it's never too late if you believe you can change.
Yeah. I mean, just to give the listeners, you know, so they've got a sort of context. I'm 54. So yeah, I recovered in my mid to late 40s. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. So let's maybe go back to where it started. So we know there's never one cause of an eating disorder or disordered eating, but what was your relationship with food and your body like when you were growing up?
So I was thinking about this before the podcast, and, you know, as a young child, I think there was nothing unusual. I was the youngest of two. I've got a sister 2 years older than me, very, let's say, dominant, very vocal. I was always the quieter one. And, you know, I think even living in that eating disorder world, we're working with eating disorders, when you hear that, you say, I was the quieter one, I had a dominant sister, you think, well, that's one of the predisposing factors, isn't it? And so there was that. But my relationship with food as a child was absolutely normal until, I say that, but, you know, my mother was very traditional. You know, we had to eat what was on our plate, which in those days was just very normal. Pudding was always fruit, apart from, you know, sometimes at weekends we'd have a treat. I remember we had sweets on a Sunday. We had money given to us on a Sunday. And it was, I lived in Belgium as a child and then France. So I didn't grow up in England. So in Belgium, it was Belgian francs. I remember we were giving 10 francs, which I think was 10p at the time. And I remember walking to the baker with my dad on a Sunday, getting the sweets. And there was a whole sort of selection of sweets. So, you know, that was all, you know, normal stuff. And when I was about, I must have been about 8 or 9, I had this problem. I'm not even sure what it was, looking back. It was something to do with bloating and gas and things. So they did a barium meal. I don't know if you've ever heard of a barium meal. It's the most horrible thing. You have to swallow, like, you know, McDonald's milkshakes, the size of a massive McDonald's milkshake, of sort of barium. It's revolting. It is so I was really little and young, you know, and I had to swallow this whole thing. And then they do an x-ray to see what's happening with it. Anyway, so that, looking back, must have been pretty traumatic. So there was already from that age an awareness of sort of digestion, food, you know, it was all related. So there was that. And then when I was about 12, we were living in Paris. I was sent for some unknown reason for a load of blood tests because my parents thought I was putting on weight more than I should be. Now, looking back, it was probably just puppy fat at the age of 12. So goodness knows what they were thinking. But my dad is very obsessed with shape and food. Shape, weight, and food. So, you know, the writing was on the wall in a way. So there was that. So I remember after those blood tests, I do remember coming downstairs one day from getting ready for school, coming downstairs for breakfast and saying to my mother, look, I haven't got any fat rolling over the top of my skirt. You know, that was the age of 12. So, you know, I say it started when I was 15, 16, but actually there were signs of it before then, of that awareness. And then the setting was right
for it to start. It's like these little seeds being planted and watered, like the strong messages. And as you probably know, like when we're younger, we don't have all the filters that we do when we're older, like our critical mind. Exactly. We just accept what our parents are telling us. We're like a little sponge and take it in. So you're obviously thinking, oh, wait, I shouldn't be that way. Yeah, that's quite a powerful story. I think a lot of people will be able to relate to that as well. And I guess what was it that changed then at 15, 16 that you'd sort of previously pinpointed the start as this time?
So this, all this time I was living in, well, Brussels till I was 10 and then Paris until I was 16. And at 16, my parents wanted me to go back to England to school for sixth form to do A-levels because I'd never had schooling in England before. And I really didn't want to. And my sister done the same thing 2 years before, loved it. She went to a very well-known boarding school in England. And I applied and I got in. And the fact I got in, it was, oh, well, you've got in, so you've got to go. And so I did go reluctantly. And that was the real trigger because I remember getting there and thinking it was a decision. I thought everything is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
It was the classic control thing. Nothing to do with my weight. It was everything is out of control. There's one thing I can control here, and that's my weight. And so that's what happened.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that eating disorders, is about the food and the weight, or it becomes about the food and the weight. Yeah. But in the beginning, it's usually about something else. And maybe it goes towards the food because those seeds have been planted earlier, like you say, with that barium drink thing and everything else is there. If it wasn't the eating disorder, it might have actually been some other way. Unhelpful way that you would have coped in that situation.
Yeah,
I've never been to boarding school, but I've heard very mixed experiences from people.
I think it depends so much on your personality. So my sister loved it, absolutely loved it. I hated it, but then I only spent 1 year there, hated every minute of it, I think, because it was a new country, new culture, new language, everything. And then I went back to Paris for my final year of school, and that was boarding, but it was much smaller and it was familiar to me, and I loved the school there. So I actually loved that experience, but it was very unlike your classic English boarding school. It was so different. So it was great going back.
And I guess without sharing all the details, it might kind of be too much, but how was it that you took the control, like, towards food?
What, as in, how did that? So I wanted to control food. So I stopped eating, basically. Mm-hmm. So at the boarding school, you know, meals were in the refectory. Well, I didn't go. So I'd buy myself, it was these sort of, it wasn't rice cakes. They didn't have those in those days. They were actually bigger and heavier than those, but packs of those sort of crisp bread type mm-hmm. things and fruit. And that's what I'd live off. I literally, and how I did it, I don't know, because I was in the swimming team. So I'd be training for swimming. I was in the squash team. So I'd be training for squash. I'd be having to study. And I'd do it on an apple a day and maybe put a cottage cheese as well and these little rice cakes. And, you know, looking back, I think, how did I survive? But I did.
Yeah. Is that something you hear quite a lot of clients now? Because it's something I hear quite a lot when they've almost had that turning point. Maybe they are starting to eat more or starting to eat in a different pattern. And they're like, I don't know how I did it. Mm-hmm. How on earth did I put myself through that almost? But you don't realize at the time. Yeah. Because you're so focused and sort of driven. And I guess, was that flagged up as something at the time, or did you just sort of, I'll say, get away with it? That's not a good phrase.
I mean it was originally a boys' boarding school. Girls were only coming along in the sixth form, so girls were quite a new sort of phenomenon, and I think all the teachers didn't quite know what to do with us, so they weren't looking out for it. And also, it was, well, I'm 54 now, so it was however long ago. It was a long time ago. Eating disorders weren't really talked about or recognised then. So that combination of being in a predominantly boys' school and, you know, eating disorders not being that common. So the school didn't do anything. And I would phone my parents regularly and say, I want to go back to school in France. They'd say no. And then my dad sent me to a psychiatrist who was a complete nutter. But the one thing he said, this was during that year, he said, Caroline should go back to school in Paris. So I'll always be grateful to him for that. And my dad really respected him, so they let me go back.
It sounds like you were happier when you went back. Did that affect your eating at all, or did it kind of stay the same?
No, it got a lot better. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, isn't it? Because you'd think once anorexia had set in, it did get better. And I think my parents obviously talked to the people I was living with in the boarding house and asked them to keep an eye on it. But I don't remember it being an issue. And it's hard, isn't it, when you look, because of suffering for so long, there were periods of it being a bit better, but it was just there in the background. And then whenever any stress came up, it would get bad again. So that year was actually, I think, because I had my best friend who I'd been at school with since the age of 10. I was back with her, familiar surroundings, just really happy. So, you know, I wouldn't say I put all the weight back on, but I was eating pretty well. I mean, I probably was still restricting, but it wasn't an issue. So,
I'm glad we touched on that, because that was something I was going to ask you, like, did it stay quite stable? Or, yeah, I know from people's stories, it does kind of have, again, maybe not the best phrasing, but better periods and worse periods, or definitely kind of more severe, and then you'll come out for it a bit, which I think is actually really helpful when you're going into recovery to reflect, like, oh, what was it those times that I was feeling a bit better, or maybe the voice was a bit quieter, the symptoms weren't there as much, what was going on in my life, so we can look to bring more of that in or conversely, what was happening at the times when I felt like I needed it more, and you've identified like stress being a big trigger.
Yeah, because then I had a gap year. And again, I lived with my best friend. We lived in London and we had just an amazing time. But talking to her, because we're still best friends now, and she says, you know, you weren't eating properly in that year. And I was happy, but I was obviously using food. You know, going to London was a big change. We're living in a flat on our own, which was great and really exciting. But, you know, it's a big thing at 18. And I look back at the meals. I remember eating grape nuts, obsessed with grape nuts and yogurt. Mm-hmm. And I think my suppers used to consist of grape nuts and yogurt. And so, you know, I wasn't eating properly at all.
Yeah. How did that affect your digestive system? Because I know I went through a phase of eating too much fiber and it was not a good situation.
No, I don't remember it affecting it, actually. Maybe I've got a very strong digestive system. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't remember any adverse effects, actually. So I do remember crunching my teeth a lot. You know, grape nuts are really hard. I don't know if they still sell them there. I don't know.
I think they do. I think I've had them before. They're not like pellets, but they're quite thin.
They are little. And they're really crunchy. They're delicious, but they are really crunchy.
Yeah, and I suppose, just to say as well, if someone, a random average person, wanted to have grape nuts and yogurt for dinner, it's not specifically a problem in itself. It's just how it fits in to everything else that you're eating, how you're thinking about that food. Your
reasons. I mean, in itself, that's quite healthy. Grain nuts and yogurt is quite healthy, but probably better to have it for breakfast, or if you've eaten well during the day and you just want a snack in the evening, that's fine. But I think probably I hadn't eaten well during the day. So yeah, it's all in context, isn't it?
Yeah. And I guess from what I know about you, it sounds like you have achieved a lot in your life, even with that anorexia sort of hanging over you. In the periods that it did seem a bit worse, did you recognize almost this is limiting me, or were you looking more towards like, this is helping me? Did that make sense as a question?
Yeah, it was. So I'm trying to think. So I then went off to university, and it was again, I'd say at that point, I was on the very low end of healthy. So people would say to me, you're so lucky, you're so thin. They didn't think you're anorexic. And I, you know, little did they know how I was having to control everything. But I was just about healthy enough to stop people saying you need help. And because there wasn't so much help around then anyway. So if it had been nowadays, probably I'd have been sent off for help much sooner. And then, so then actually I'm trying to think. So yeah, then at the second year of university, I started going out with a guy, then we split up and my weight plummeted. So that was one of the really bad dips. I think it went so low. But then I started going out with my husband soon after, and it went up on its own. So it just shows, you know, that how life with stress is, how I was using it so much to control, you know, my happiness, my, you know, it was based on whether I was happy, whether I was sad. But I went very low, you know, worrying weight, but it did go up on its own when I started going out with my husband.
What do you think changed when you started going out with him?
I think I could focus on other, I had other stuff to focus on. I think it's as simple as that. I didn't have to worry about what I was in. There was more important things in my life to think about, you know, going out for meals with him. We used to play squash together. Well, obviously I needed to be strong to do that. Just life was going on in a lovely way. So I didn't need to control my food. You know, I think for me, whenever I had the lapses, it was because of my need to control a situation and then to control my food because things weren't going right.
Yeah. And did you recognize that at the time? Like, did you recognize like, this is not good for me? No, she's shaking her head.
The word anorexia wasn't even mentioned. And I do remember having a few fights with my dad about, I remember once, it must have been when I come home for the holidays from school and we were going off to play squash, and he stopped halfway and he pulled out a piece of cake, chocolate cake. And he said, we can only play squash if you eat this. And, you know, we all know how stubborn anorexics can be. And I refused to eat it. I absolutely refused. You know, that was how strong it was. So we had to turn, he said, I'm not playing squash with you if you don't eat it. So, you know, they obviously recognized what was going on, but it was never really talked about. And anorexia was never mentioned until much later on.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Like you say, when you met your husband, you almost did have that value shift of like, actually, it's more important for me now to go out for a meal with him and have that experience than, like you say, refuse to do that. Whereas in a situation a while before, it'd been actually, you know, my food rules are almost more the most important thing at this minute. But yeah, interesting.
And I don't actually remember when I started going out with him. I don't remember thinking, okay, I can start eating now, or it's more important. I'm going to have to make it. Wasn't difficult. You know, later on, it was much, you know, so for my sort of full recovery, it was much more difficult. But I suppose because I wasn't actually still fully recovered, I'd started eating, but there were still a lot of food rules looking back. So it's just quasi-recovery.
Yeah, I've heard that quite a lot, that kind of quasi, or like sometimes people pronounce that
quasi-recovery.
I'm like, let's carry on with the story order and see what comes out. So you'd met your husband, I guess, what comes next in the story?
So very quickly, marriage. We've been married for 31 years, but we literally, I mean, people can't believe it, especially our children. We started going out at the end of November. We got engaged in the March and we got married in the September.
Oh, wow.
When you know, you know, you know. And I knew him before. So he was a flatmate. You don't really need all these details, but he was a flatmate of the person I went out with before, who I split up with and was so upset about. And then he's sneaked in and got there. So, but it all worked out well in the end. So yeah, we got married very quickly. I was still at university. just about to go into my third year of university when we got married. And so things were okay for a while. But, you know, I look back at photos sometimes, I think, gosh, it was so thin. You know, just I was, like I said before, I was probably just about healthy enough to stop people saying you've got to get help. But I wasn't healthy, really. And my whole mental state wasn't healthy. It wasn't right.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because I think in the media nowadays, probably even then, to some extent, there's this image of what anorexia looks like. And that's partly come from the diagnostic criteria, but also you can be having those thoughts and feelings and behaviors, but your body weight has dropped. Actually, sometimes when people are engaging, your body weight doesn't even drop that much, but mentally and in terms of your quality of life, definitely you're not living life to the full.
It's if I look back, I was counting calories every single day, you know, which obviously I never do now, don't have a clue. And I was thinking about that the other day. I thought, I don't even know things that I used to know just like that. If you said how many calories and such, it's as if it's been wiped from my brain. I actually don't know how many calories and things that I knew so well before.
I'm so glad you said that, because sometimes when my clients are calorie counting and then they say to me like, oh, but I'll never not know. Do you know, this is like seared in my brain now. And I'm like, I don't think, because I used to calorie count to some extent, not all the time throughout my eating disorder, but at one point I got very heavily reliant on it. And I was like, I feel like if you give me a multiple choice quiz with like, there's three answers, how many calories is that in? I could probably pick the right one.
Yeah.
But if you just asked me, I can't remember stuff that used to be like literally every day I would write down the calories.
I used to get notes, you know, if I was writing an essay for my exam or something, I'd be writing notes on the side of paper about how many calories I had. I remember in the margin,
you know,
an apple, a rice cake, a piece of bit of yogurt, whatever, counted it up. Crazy.
Yeah, and just imagine how much more brain space you would have had.
I know, it's ridiculous.
I think actually what episode is it, maybe episode 4, for anyone who cares, when I spoke to Emma, she was also talking about her experience of an eating disorder at university and kind of saying similar things to you about how much it just kind of just seeps into your everyday kind of things, doesn't it? So yeah, I'm so glad you said though, and agree with me. Actually, you can change your mindset. So actually, those things aren't important. You don't need to know how many calories certain food has in it. Okay, I'm just going to say back to the story because I can't remember what we were talking about before we were saying that.
University, got married, finished university. We moved out of London. I was trying to get pregnant. Couldn't. Surprise, surprise. So I had fertility drugs. I was given fertility drugs, which worked. So I had my first child, Nick. So I was 26 then, 25 when I got pregnant, 26 when I had him. And then 20 months later, I had twins.
So did you have twins? I didn't realize you had twins.
Yeah. Boy and a girl. Yeah, so that was really fun, but yeah, pretty full on for a while. So yeah, that was an interesting time, being pregnant, having children. But I was okay. You know, I was all right through all that time. My pregnancies weren't great. I mean, I couldn't get pregnant, felt sick for the first 4 months, ended up in hospital for 5 weeks before Nick, the eldest, was born, 10 weeks in hospital before the twins were born, cesareans. So the whole process was just pretty horrendous, but I got there in the end.
Yeah, I should imagine that's quite difficult as well in pregnancy if you're already not wanting to eat for certain reasons of the eating disorder, and then it's like, oh, but I feel sick, almost as an excuse not to. Or did you know I need to eat for this baby? Sometimes people have that.
You know, it's funny, I think because I felt so ill, and I felt, you know, morning sickness is just the most ridiculous term, because anyone who's had pregnancy sickness knows it's not just in the morning. Well, if you're lucky, it might be, but you know, it was all day, all night. Every time I woke up in the night, it started again.
Oh my gosh.
So I think when you're feeling sick like that, you actually want to eat something to make you feel a bit better. So with Nick, I think it was pizza, which, you know, I never would have dreamt of touching before. With the twins, it was those awful crab sticks, you know, that
I know you
mean, crab in at all, those synthetic pink sticks with mayonnaise and white bread, and that performance. But I suppose I didn't eat much else apart from that. But I, you know, I wasn't worried about getting bigger. I think I was very fortunate for me that I literally had a bump. That was it. Mm-hmm. You know, even with the twins, I just had a bump. So I didn't get bigger anywhere else.
Yeah.
And I can actually accept that because I thought, well, there's a baby in there. It's not fat. It's a baby. And then it was two babies. So, you know, I know a lot of people with eating disorders really struggle with being pregnant. And I get it. I really get it with changing shape and things. But I think because I was so desperate to get pregnant and I'd always wanted to be a mother, you know, that was my sort of childhood dream, that actually being pregnant, that was okay. It was afterwards that was more difficult.
Okay. What was it about the after? And also, I was going to ask you too, I was just thinking, because we've not really talked about body image, have we? We talked a lot about, oh, it's food and control, yeah. But often with an eating disorder, it starts as that. And then I actually put my Instagram this morning, like part of the diagnostic criteria is this body image, unduly influences your self-esteem, which I think, slight side note, sometimes it's a difficult conversation to have, I think, because there's a sort of anti-diet, like fat liberation movements and stuff. But I think it's a slightly different kettle of fish when we're talking about eating disorders, because saying like fat is bad and terrifying is part of the eating disorder. Yeah. It's not just your opinion in a way, if that makes sense.
I mean, I think looking back, see, body image has been a much bigger issue for me since I recovered.
Oh, okay.
And I've had to work on it a lot, and we can talk about it maybe a bit at the end of the story with the body image bit comes in. Up till then, when I was in my anorexia, even at times when I was a bit better, I think because I was still very thin, deep down I knew I was thin, although I didn't like my, do you know what I mean? I think looking back, I knew I wasn't fat. I was terrified of putting on weight, but I knew I was actually quite thin. There was something in me telling me you are actually thin. So I did know it. So that wasn't actually the body image bit really came into play as I was recovering. That was when I really struggled with it. And I've done a lot of work on it in the last few years.
Yeah. Maybe we'll go into that specifics about what that work looked like a little bit later. So with the pregnancies, you didn't have a good time in terms of physically feeling well, but didn't affect the eating disorder too much. And then I guess what was it after that
actually saying that I think being in hospital was actually really convenient for me with eating disorder, because I remember I was in hospital, food was disgusting, and looking back I remember now actually thinking, well, it's great excuse I don't have to eat anything, because I do remember the consultant coming in to me one day and saying, you've got to eat more. So there was obviously, it's funny what you forget, isn't it, over the years, but
yeah.
So there was obviously stuff being said that I wasn't eating enough. So it was very convenient for me being.
Yeah, I was going to say the voice finds any excuse that it can have.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is why I was wondering before if when you were like sick, it's like, oh no, I don't have to eat anything now because I'm sick. But like you say, actually settling your stomach was more important at that point.
Yeah. So yeah, then hospital. So for 5 weeks, obviously, I didn't eat much. And then the 10 weeks with the twins particularly. I mean, I think they weighed me and I don't know if I was losing weight. I can't really remember, but yeah, I didn't, apart from the babies, there wasn't a lot of extra weight there. Mm-hmm. So then when I had them, I mean, I was back in my jeans after 2 weeks. Now that's not really normal after having twins, I would say.
Yeah.
So, but I was very proud of it, obviously. And I was saying, oh, it's just my genetics, you know, it's my makeup. But clearly it was because I hadn't really been feeding myself properly during the pregnancy.
I trust that your babies turned out healthy and fine, but it's not a good approach for anyone.
They were 5 weeks early.
They were
in special care. Actually, no, they weren't. My daughter was in special care for one night because they thought she had an infection, but yeah, we were really fortunate. They were tube fed for 10 days because they didn't have the sucking reflex, but yeah, we were really, really lucky.
Sometimes it's thinking, it's not worth chancing it, is it? Because could have.
But they say, you know, when you're pregnant, everything goes to your baby. So I was so depleted. Every morsel I was eating, not that there was a lot, it went to the babies, not to me. So there was nothing left for me.
So, and then I should imagine babies crying at night. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to deplete you.
Oh, well, yeah, and with a 20-month-old and then the twins as well. Yeah, it was, I suppose, for 3 or 4 years, it was exhausting. It was exhausting. And over that time, I remember thinking, well, I'm giving. You know, my husband worked really hard. He was very rarely around during the week. He'd get back late at night. Weekends, he was exhausted. So, you know, and he's admitted. He said, you were a single parent, really. Mm. And we didn't have help. And, you know, looking back, I think, who was I trying to prove something to? I should have just got somebody in at least for a couple of hours a week so I could go to Sainsbury's on my own. I mean, literally, I used to take them all shopping. By the time they were all in the trolley, I could fit about one bunch of bananas in the trolley, and that was it. Now, you know, so it was exhausting. But I think at that time I thought, okay, I'm giving to everyone else. My thing is food. I can control my food. So although, again, my weight wasn't really worryingly low, it stayed pretty low. Because I was controlling it, because it was my thing. That was my one thing in all that chaos and, you know, no time for myself. I actually found something for me and it gave me satisfaction.
Like you say, something to hold on to and give you satisfaction. Yeah. How did you, just kind of sort of related question, how did you find feeding your kids in terms of like preparing their food and stuff? Because I know sometimes for people that can be quite tricky.
Do you know, it was fine. I think I was really lucky in that I could feed them. I could eat in front of other people. I didn't have fear of eating in front of other people. So I think because I had it for so long and into my adult life, I realized I had to be able to function in society. If I want, you know, I was married with children. I wanted to lead a supposedly outwardly looking normal life. So if we went out to supper with friends, I would eat perfectly well, so it would look on the outside as if I was didn't have a problem. I didn't cut my food up small. I didn't, you know, have any of the classic habits of an anorexic. I ate everything. I'd have pudding, you know, no problem. But what they didn't know was I'd exercised and not eaten all day.
Was it almost like playing the part in a way of cutting up that front to say, oh, this is
so nobody really knew. So but feeding, going back to feeding the children, I think because I was so keen to be a good mother, I fed them properly when they were younger. I fed them properly all the way through. But as they got older, they picked up on my weird habits. And that's when issues arose as they were teenagers. That's when it got more difficult.
Yeah, I wonder if you could tell us some more about that.
Yeah, so it was particularly, so then when they were about 10, 11, we went skiing and I had a skiing accident. I wrecked my knee, stretchered down to the clinic. They did all their little tests on my knee. They said, right, you've done your ACL, your cruciate ligament. You'll need surgery. You won't be able to exercise for 9 months. Well, you can imagine what that did to me. I remember hobbling out of that clinic thinking, can't exercise, can't eat. It was that clear. And that was my biggest lapse. From that day, I hardly ate anything. And within weeks, I dropped weight so badly. So that, because the children were that much older, they noticed then. So that was when I found help for the first time ever, really. I'd been to therapy as an outpatient once a week, but it was because my sister had said to me, oh, you need help, you need to go and get help. And I just to keep her quiet, I'd say, okay. But it was the you know, everybody who's been through an eating disorder knows, went to the therapy, sat in the session, was weighed, spit away, oh, you need to eat this, I'll eat that, I'll do this, I'll do that. You walk out and you do your own thing. You know, so a complete waste of time because I didn't want to get better. I didn't really think I had a problem. But then after the skiing accident, you know, my weight got very low. It was clear I had a problem. And I'd come across this woman in Sussex where we were living who just set up this house for girls, women, but only 4 or 5 at a time. It was amazing. She'd been running a centre in hospital, or, you know, an anorexic department or whatever you call it, and didn't agree with hospital treatment because she could see what was happening. You were being refed. The psychological side wasn't really tackled. People went home and then ended up in hospital again. So she set up the centre and I went to her because my husband said, look, if you don't get better, you're going into hospital. I said, I am not going into hospital. I said, give me a week, I'll find an alternative. And I went to this woman, again, classic anorexic, saying, feeling like a fraud. But looking back, you know, I was a stick. I looked awful, but I said, oh, well, people seem to think I've got a problem. I'm fine, really. But, you know, would you take me on sort of just to keep everyone happy? she could obviously see just by looking.
Yeah,
at me,
she was probably like, okay, yeah. All right.
So I went there for 18 months and it was amazing. And I had to be there. I said, I'm not staying the night there because it was a residential place. Mm-hmm. I said, I am not staying the night because I've got children. So I had to be there at breakfast. And obviously even then with the children, it was difficult. We had to get childcare and everything, but it was better than staying overnight. And I could only go after supper. So I had all my meals and mm-hmm. snacks there 5 days a week. And then at weekends, I was at home. And it was brilliant because it was a very gentle refeeding program. So, for example, when you arrived, if you're very underweight, you'd have at lunchtime, say, one potato. Somebody mm-hmm. who'd been there for a while, was putting on weight, had to have four. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they weren't thrusting 3,000 calories down your neck the day you arrived. It was, but it was tough, you know, it was sort of tough love. It wasn't easy at all, but they allowed the psychological side to keep up with the physical mm-hmm. side, which is why it took so long. So I got a lot better. And, you know, that helped me subsequently when I relapsed again. And then I had made a full recovery. That 18 months was invaluable in the tools I learned, the techniques, all of that. So I drew strength from that when I really fully recovered.
Yeah, it sounds like as well, like what you did day to day in like the clinic or wasn't in your control, but actually choosing, you've chosen to be there at that time, yeah. chosen to engage, which I think is so important in recovery. Actually, I'm just going to ask you this question now because I was going to ask you at the end and I think it ties into what we're talking about now. So I kind of hate it when people say, oh, it takes 7 to 14 years to recover from an eating disorder, because I think you can suffer for that long. But I think once you've made that choice to recover, I don't think it takes that long. And I think it puts people off to think, oh God, it's going to take 7 years from now. I kind of might as well not bother. It's not worth it. So I was just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because I think it can be very quick to get to a really healthy stage when you've decided to recover. It really can. But like I was saying before, things like there are little bits of the puzzle that are left that you, like for me, the last bit of the puzzle was body image. So it didn't mean I wasn't recovered before, but there were just bits I still needed to work on. So I don't think, I agree with you, Rachel, that no, it doesn't take between, it doesn't need to take between 7 and 14 years to recover at all. Once I decided, but that point at the clinic, that wasn't, I would say, my point of recovery. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get better, but the anorexic voice didn't want me to still.
Yeah.
So the anorexic voice was still strong, although I made massive progress. I liken it to that anorexic voice was still inside me rather than mm-hmm. outside me.
Yeah.
So although I was fighting it, I was conscious of it, I was aware of it, I was talking back to it, and I got a lot better, it was still inside me. So until the real recovery happened, when the real recovery happened, it was pretty quick.
Yeah, I'm just going to ask you about that in a second. But just to say about, like you were saying, you can be recovered and then it gets better almost. Yeah. I kind of say to my clients, I'm like, oh, how do I know when I recovered? We kind of talk about, okay, well, what would it look like to you? What kind of things would you be doing? And I kind of feel like it's some kind of line in the sand that you cross and you're like, right, this is it. You've kind of made that decision. Right, I'm never going back. And obviously, I can't say what would happen in my future, but this moment I feel 99.9% confident that I'm not going back because I know how terrible it was. But then it can keep getting better. You can get more freedom. And then, because even now, sometimes I'm pretty open. I realize that I've got a food rule that I didn't even remember was a food rule, but like my client will bring something up and I think, oh, I do that out of habit. Not that it gives me anxiety anymore, but it's, oh, I kind of do that. Wait, let me challenge that. Oh, now I've got more freedom. It doesn't affect my day to day, but it can just keep getting,
and you don't realize better. You look back, you think, wow, this year I'm even better than last year. Last year was great, but now it's even better. And I don't know what to liken it to, but it's so true that you can be fully recovered, but you can even be even more fully recovered. That makes sense.
So when did full recovery come for you? So you said you had made like these big leaps, you were feeling a lot healthier. And then there was sort of a lapse or
there was. Relapse. So then we moved to Madrid straight after I left the clinic. Things were great. I was telling everyone I was recovered, sort of singing from the rooftops. And then I had to eat my words, because so in Madrid it was great, but again, I was very low weight. You know, I was healthy, but people were saying, oh, you're so lucky, you're so thin. You know, going out to supper, if I went out to supper, I had to make sure I did the exercise, didn't eat. Remember when the children were at school, all I'd have was apple and yogurt for lunch every day. That was my lunch. You know, if people asked me out to lunch, I'd slightly panic. So a lot of the habits were still there, although I was maintaining, you know, a healthy-ish lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And from the outside, I looked pretty good. And to the public, my habits were normal because I made them normal for everyone else to see. So then we moved back to England. And then it was that summer and the twins were 15 and Nick was 16. So, you know, it was summer holidays, three teenagers in the house, pretty full on and hormonal. And I remember thinking, okay, I just need some, you know, from a healthy viewpoint, I thought, I need some space every day to myself. I just need to get out on my own. So what did I do? I started going to the gym every morning or every day, which in itself would be fine. Mm-hmm. But without me even realizing it, the weight started dropping. So it wasn't a conscious decision. It's extraordinary. When you look back, I think, how did it happen? And I think it's because that anorexia was still in me. Mm-hmm. So the weight started dropping. Subconsciously, I think I must have thought, this is good. I like this. So yeah. Then all the habits started coming back.
I would also say, even in terms of how some people, like inverted commas, kind of accidentally get an eating disorder. So there's some evidence that sometimes when people have had glandular fever and they've lost a lot of weight, then they develop an eating disorder because of that. So it's also for some people something about that sort of weight threshold,
yeah,
as well, being like, oh, okay, voice is stronger. I don't know if you find with your clients or you found in your recovery as well, often it is when someone's weight comes up, then the voice is getting quieter. Obviously, if we've done the psychological work too, not just as a direct correlation, but then kind of it can go the other way as well. And like dropping weight, the voice is getting louder.
Definitely.
And louder. So yeah.
I think it is. It's definitely that. And without you even realizing it, I think, you know, obviously you know all about brain function when you're low weight. And so it just kicked in again and it got bad really quickly. And that's when it really affected the children. And my daughter said to a friend, I'm really scared mummy's going to die.
Mm.
You know, and that was relayed to me. And it shows how strong the anorexic voice is. Even then, I didn't get better. You know, and I'm so close to my children. But even my daughter being frightened I was going to die, I mean, how strong must anorexia be to override that fear from your daughter that you're not prepared to get better even for that? So that was really tough. And I refused help. I did go to the Priory for some outpatient sessions. It was a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
I think because I knew it all in a way, because I'd done that 18 months in the clinic. I knew what I had to do, but I just didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can all tell me to eat. I don't want to. I'm enjoying being thin again and being anorexic. I was actually enjoying it because that became my focus. You know, it became my sole purpose in life, as it does. It's you know, it's the only egg in your basket, so to speak, isn't it? So I suppose it must have been about 2 years I was like that. So it was really bad. One morning I got up and I was drying my hair in my bedroom, sitting at my dressing table with a mirror, and I looked down, you know, when you cross your legs, and I looked down and it was like a veil was lifted. And I looked at my legs and I thought, they're really disgusting. I could see them for what they were. And I looked in the mirror and I thought, I am fed up with this. I've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to that point. I was, as they say, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that was the turning point. And I thought, you know what? I've had it with this. And it didn't happen overnight, obviously, because you don't suddenly go from restricting and, you know, your body has to adjust and everything, but and mentally as well. But that was the point I decided I wanted to get better. So it was, in a way, it was easy. In a way, it was obviously very difficult. But because I then truly wanted to get better, I got better pretty quickly after that.
Yeah, I think it is that mental turning point, isn't it, of like, I'm so done with this. It's like your own rock bottom, which feels different to different people. Like, I think I've shared mine before. Well, it was a kind of series of events over a couple of months. But the main one of like, right, going to get help now, rather than me googling how to get help and never trusting that anyone could help me. Like I tried to have a nice day out and then the bulimia came with me and I was just like, I cannot even have one nice day out free from this. I'm so angry with it now.
Yeah.
When before it was like helping me, it was like helping me avoid things and various other reasons that we won't go into, just because this podcast is not about me. but yeah, it's just that you're so angry with it then, aren't you?
Yeah,
that it's taking over your life in that way.
It is.
You want that actual control back rather than using it for control.
Totally. And it was. I just thought, this is not serving me anymore. You know, it really isn't. And I could see that there was so much more to life. And so, yeah, I decided to get better.
It's so funny when you say that, because that's like, that literally is what it is. But I know it's so annoying advice when people are like, oh, I just decided to get better.
I know.
But
well, how?
That's it, though. Yeah.
And it's so difficult. You know, people, I was talking to somebody the other day and she said, but how do I flick that switch? And there's no one answer, is there? I think, you know, the work I'd done before at the clinic, just the years and years of living with it, and everybody comes to a point, you know, comes to that point at different times. You know, you can't predict when it's going to be. So yeah, that was the turning point.
Yeah, I think there are proactive things you could do. I mean, I feel like the person's got to have the willingness first to engage. But once you've engaged, like you've done the same training as me, haven't you, with National Center for Eating Disorder, exactly. I think they give us loads of really good tools. Like I've kind of written an ebook based on like the pros and cons able activity, just because I think
and
that's so insightful.
That writing that letter in 5 years time, if you're not recovered, if you are, that just puts it down on paper, doesn't it? You know.
Yeah. Do you want to explain to people a little bit more about that, since we've covered it, how they might be able to implement that?
Yeah. So I did it with a client the other day, actually, and it was really powerful. So you write a letter to your therapist normally saying, so somebody, if my, one of my clients say, dear Caroline, it's 5 years since I last saw you and I've recovered and this is what my life is like. And it would generally go into, you know, I've got a great relationship, I'm loving life, I'm doing loads of things, all of that. Then they do another letter at the same time saying, dear Caroline, 5 years since I've seen you, no progress, haven't recovered, this is what my life is like. And it just is very black and white and very clear to the person suffering, my goodness, do I really want to live another 5 years like I am now?
I think like you say,
it just emphasizes, doesn't it?
It's something about having written it down as well. It's almost like the eating disorder can't twist it in the same way as it can if it's just a thought in your head. It's like, no, look, here it is on paper. Exactly. You can have that choice or that choice.
Yeah.
Which one do you want? Most people are like, oh, actually, that 5 years and I've recovered sounds a lot nicer. Mm. Yeah.
And it's not, you know, when I say, well, that was a switch and I got better, it sounds so easy and I don't want to say to people, oh, I had an easy time, and they should as well. It's not easy. It's not easy, but it's much easier when you've decided to recover and you can then recognize that anorexic voice and you can fight it. And you know, it just for me became more and more distant, that voice, until it had gone.
Amazing. That is also really positive to hear, because I think some people kind of think like, oh, it's going to be with me forever. And for some people, I think recovery to them does look like, right, it might be there, but I can tune it right down.
Yeah.
But also, like you're saying, there's a possibility that it's gone, you don't hear from it. And I suppose also the other thing that I would love to have a chat about, I think I end up talking to loads of people about this, but I think it's so important for people. Are there certain things that you do now, or certain ways that stretch your life, that are kind of new habits that would stop you from almost going backwards? So like, I guess you're not going to do a crazy exercise program or anything.
No, I mean, being a health coach, I mean, I couldn't do what I do if I still had an eating disorder. What example would I be? And you can't lie. People can tell if you're not being authentic. You know, I couldn't specialize in eating disorders if I had an eating disorder myself. You know, so I've had to be so honest with myself to say, am I truly recovered? Because otherwise I cannot, one, take money from people, and more importantly, play with their emotions and their health and their lives, if I can't genuinely say I am recovered. So I wouldn't be able to do my job. And that is my passion now. And also to be a good example to my children. I couldn't genuinely be a good example to my children now if I hadn't recovered. So to be able to do that is great. And I, do you know, I get so few injuries now. I remember I used to live at the physio, you know, with pulled muscles sorry, I'm just plugging my phone in here. You know, pulled tendons, ligaments, all of that. I couldn't do that. You know, now I'm fully recovered, and I haven't been to the physio for years. So, you know, it's things like that. But I think mostly it's my work, which now is, you know, I love what I do and I love helping people. And I couldn't do that if I wasn't recovered.
Yeah, I think same here. I think that was I was saying there were several things over several months that were the turning point. And one of mine was getting a business coach as well. Like, I wasn't recovered, but I'd made that decision. This is what I'm doing. So you better recover now because you've just paid all this money to a business coach.
You can't otherwise, can you? Yeah.
For me, it wouldn't feel good to still be recovering, but each to their own. I know there are some therapists who are going through their own journey, but they know the skills, they know the tools, they feel confident to teach them to someone else. Yeah. But I'm kind of in the same boat as you. It doesn't feel...
It doesn't feel authentic. And it doesn't feel... I wouldn't feel right really being able to help people if I haven't, you know, got through it myself.
Yeah. And I would love to say as well, because I think a lot of people who I do have on the podcast, because I want to speak to experts in this now, have had their struggles, whether that was an eating disorder or disordered eating or body image kind of issues, and then got a profession to do with eating disorders and recovery or coaching or something. But I'm thinking of doing a mini series. I haven't found the people for it, but almost of life after recovery with people who aren't coaches, because there's like got to be hundreds of thousands of people who have recovered and have found a different like passion and purpose in life that keeps them recovered.
I'm sure it's a really interesting topic. It really is.
Search out the people. If anyone's listening and they're like, oh, that's me, I'm not sure why you'd be listening if that was you. Maybe you're just interested in other people's stories. But anything else you want to say before the last question? Was there anything else that you want to...
Should we just touch on the body image bit?
As
I say, I recovered and I struggled as I was putting on the weight. So I got to a weight which I'd never been at before in my adult life, teenage life. So that I found very difficult. But I knew I wasn't prepared to go back to losing the weight. So I was in a real conflict. I thought, well, I'm not going back. You know, there's no way I'm going back to how I was. So what do? I'm stuck with this body, which I don't really like very much. And I used to look at them. My thing was my legs, and I'm only 5'2". So, you know, I feel it all goes on my legs, which is completely irrational. But, you know, I'm not tall. So I thought, I've got to find a way around this. And it, you know, I did a lot of sort of just self-talk, positive self-talk and mantras and, you know, life is more than the size of your legs and just silly things, but that really helped. And people don't care what size jeans you're wearing. And isn't it more important to be healthy and fit and happy and to live a full life than to be a size 4 or 6 or whatever? And it was funny because I was thinking about it. And when I was anorexic, the anorexia was my reassurance. When I was recovering and sort of going through these body image wobbles, my husband was my reassurance. So I used to ask him regularly, do I look too big? Am I getting too big? Because I stopped weighing myself because weighing was just such a trigger. So I couldn't tell from the scales. So he was my sort of my feedback. You know, I didn't know, I couldn't see in the mirror what I would look like because, you know, anorexics can't, or even I think when you're recovered, I think it's very difficult. I recognize now what I see isn't what other people see, but I know that. So I used to say to him, do I look all right? Poor guy, he was so patient and he'd always be reassuring. Well, I can't remember the last time I asked him because I don't need to know, because now it comes from me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't need that reassurance from anyone else. I am happy with who I am. I don't, you know, the self-love movement, I personally struggle with a bit because I think I don't look in the mirror and say, wow, I love my legs or I love myself. You know, I love myself, but physically, I don't look in the mirror and say, whoa, you look amazing. You know, I'm 54, things change as well. But I accept how I look and I'm happy with how I look. And I think that's, you know, that's a good place to be at. I'm happy being at that place. This is who I am. I eat well. I exercise well. This is how I'm meant to be. And, you know, I'm perfectly fine with that now.
Yeah, I think acceptance is just so powerful, isn't it? just that accepting, okay, this is how, I think everyone, if you were like, oh, here's a magic wand, you could change something about your body, probably has something to change, but it's like, how important is that to you?
Yeah.
What's not that important to me?
I'm not prepared to go back. And I think my husband found, you know, when I started doing the health coaching, especially working in eating disorders, he was really worried because he thought it would trigger it. And it's so hard to explain to somebody how you know deep down it won't. Like you were saying before, you know, you're 99.9% sure you won't go back there. I'm like that. I don't want, I have no wish to go back to living how I used to live. There's nothing appealing about it. Nothing at all.
I think for me too, like when you're in work mode though, my brain processes stuff differently because I am the most like sympathetic and empathetic person ever. Like I'll watch a video on Facebook of a dog that's got a dog, it was poorly, and then cry. It recovered and then it got, I will be crying. Whereas someone tells me a story about their traumatic childhood and I'm like, okay, information. Obviously I'm empathetic to them, but it doesn't process in my brain in the same way as it does at other times. So thank you so much for sharing that. Just in the interest of time, I'm wondering, what would you say to someone who came to you and said, I just want to eat normally?
Do you know, I've been thinking about this question and all I can come up with is, and it sounds, it might be an awful answer, but I would say to them, it's as simple as that, but it's also as difficult as that. So it can be so simple. You know, now I eat normally and it is so easy. I don't even think about it. But when I was in my anorexia, it was the most difficult thing in the world. But I think what I would say to people is believe that you can. Don't give up hope that you'll always be in the thick of an eating disorder, because you don't need to be. And things will get better. And you'll look back and you think, did I really eat like that? You know, it is so simple. When you're recovered, it is so simple. So just hold on to that hope that it is so simple. You can eat normally. So I hope that's a good enough answer.
Yeah, I wish I did sound bites. I don't do sound bites. I'm a podcast lady, but I'm not very techie. I feel like that is the sound bite. Everyone will have to listen to the end to get that motivation boost, then they can listen to it every day. Like, yes, you can.
You can. You really can. You know, for somebody who's had anorexia for 30 years, I feel if I can recover, you know, and I went through so many ups and downs and I got there in the end, so don't give up.
Yeah, I think as well, people will be able to relate to a lot of the things that you've said, you know, that thought like, well, am I even meant to be here? Am I sick enough? Like, if you're having those thoughts, you can still recover. Amazing. So where can people find you if they want to connect more?
Yeah, so thank you. The best place is through my website, which is zesthealthcoaching.co.uk, and Instagram, which is @zesthealthcoaching.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
And yeah, if people want to talk to me, or yeah, just, you know, personally, you know, I don't expect people to come to me as a health coach, which they can obviously if they want help, but if they just want to talk to me about their experience and just get a bit of hope from me, I'm more than happy to talk to people.
That's so kind of you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. It's been great chatting to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Just Eat Normally podcast. I hope you found this enjoyable, interesting, and insightful and informative. And if you did, make sure to subscribe to hear the next episode. And just remember that you can check out the show notes for contact details and extra resources.